comes from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. At the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2319.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, and online at WILL.illinois.edu, will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us this afternoon. Our guest today is a woman with a passion for the Hudson River and its history. Jessica DeLong describes herself pre-2001 as a bubble-salaried dot-commer, a striving big-city editor. Today, she's a Coast Guard-licensed merchant marine officer. Jessica DeLong has written a book about her transformation. The book is also very much about our transformation as Americans over the course of our history. DeLong accomplishes this by telling a story of life aboard the fireboat, the John J. Harvey, and by looking back at the history of New York City's waterfront and the Hudson River. The book's title, My River Chronicles, Rediscovering America on the Hudson. Listeners, I invite you to join our conversation this afternoon with your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jessica DeLong is one of the world's very few female fireboat engineers. Her work as a journalist has appeared in several publications, including Newsweek, International, Rolling Stone, and Today's Machining World. The daughter of a mechanic, she's an alumna of Stanford University. Her book, My River Chronicles, Rediscovering America on the Hudson, is published by Simon & Schuster, and you will find our guest online at jessicadelong.com, www.jessicadelong.com, D-U-L-O-N-G. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Jessica DeLong, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Your book, My River Chronicles, begins with the story of a 1930 disaster involving a steamship and a fireboat, the fireboat captained by John J. Harvey. What happened?
Well, what happened was North German Lloyd Lines cargo and passenger ship. That's the way the ocean liners worked back then. People would cross the oceans at the same time as products would cross the oceans. And the ship arrived in New York Harbor, and the morning that they were scheduled to dock, dock workers discovered smoldering bags of potash, which is a fertilizer that was bound for New England farms. And the alarm went out, and the hoses were brought down from the pier shed. And because this was this frigid day on February 11, 1930, the hose lines were frozen. And so it quickly escalated to a really tremendous fire.
And that fire burned for 24 hours.
Yes, it was it was a really significant fire, not only for the loss of pilot John Harvey, who's the namesake of the fireboat that I work on, but also it ended up being instrumental in changes in the way that shipping was done. Back in that day, objects were stored side by side in the cargo holds, and it was basically, you know, rather than containerization, which is something that we're familiar with now, where there's a big box of, you know, all the same type of goods. Instead, they would just cram things into it and fill as many nooks and crannies as they could without sufficient consideration as to what cargoes might not actually make good neighbors. And following this fire, it was actually there was a change made in the way that cargo could be transported. The Dangerous Cargo Act of 1940 happened in part because of the disaster that happened to John Harvey and to the city of New York and the North German Lloyd Lines vessel.
Yeah. When did you first hear this story and begin to investigate it?
Well, I heard it as sort of, you know, mythology from the beginning of my my time on the boat, but it was just the concept that John Harvey had died in a fire, and I didn't really have any details. And slowly, as I began to immerse myself in the engine room and, you know, and got this sense of the crews who must have worked before me and got that sort of connection, that, you know, sort of spiraled out to encompass lots of things, and one of them was the life of John J. Harvey and really the moments in which he died, and that launched just a tremendous amount of research. I went to a number of archives and dug through court documents to try to piece together the story, and ended up you know, reaching out to the great grandson of different people who were involved, and it was quite a mystery and quite a detective hunt, which
yeah.
was, you know, very satisfying for me because I'm infinitely curious. So,
you're a good journalist,
and I love it.
Yeah, good writer, fine writer. What can you tell us? Tell us a little something about the man, John Harvey. Who was he?
Well, it's funny because there is actually very little information that I found available, and you know, I think that actually tells us something. The fact that this was a man who had served the fire department for decades, and yet, you know, what we have remaining are his church records. We have some information about the first time he was learning how to steer, and actually he had a bit of a I don't know, can you call it a fender bender when it's on boats? But when he was still training to become a pilot, he actually bonked into something, and there was a bit of an issue there. But beyond those tiny details, it was really hard to piece together more information. And I think there are a lot of people who do really important work whose stories end up sort of in the background, you know, sort of sight unseen. But we do know that when he died, he had been working as a firefighter for 48 years. He was 48 years old, and he had been working as a firefighter for 24 years. And he was unmarried. And he was supporting both his, and this is a quote, permanently crippled brother and his unwed sister, Sadie. And so his salary was supporting them all. And I also learned, which is really sort of a painful reality, is that supposedly this was his last day before retirement. He was basically just about to make his years and step out of the department when fate chose a different path for him.
Yeah. He sounds like someone we would call an everyday hero.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way to put it, definitely.
Yeah. So it wasn't all that long after this horrible series of explosions and this great fire that rocked the steamship and the Willett, the fireboat captained by John Harvey, that a new fireboat, your fireboat now, the John J. Harvey, was put into action. Would you describe the boat as it launched in 1931?
Yes. Well, it was the first internal combustion engine, internal combustion powered fireboat of the city at that time. Before that, the fireboats had been steam. So this was, you know, a grand event. The launching was a grand event, and with celebrations. Although I have to say that it was during Prohibition, so probably what they smashed, the bottle that they smashed on the bow, must have been sort of sparkling cider or something like that. But this was the largest, most powerful fireboat the world had ever seen. It really set the standard for emergency service vessel engineering at that point, which was still a relatively new art form. And it just set the stage for everything that came thereafter. This boat was originally built as a gasoline-electric fireboat, which, when you think about it in this day and age, that's just sort of staggering, the idea of bringing gasoline into a fire. Gasoline and huge amounts of DC electricity into a fire, just sort of, you know, we're sort of dumbstruck by that now. But and then she was converted to diesel in the 50s, and but still retains the majority of her, you know, original configuration with the DC generation and things like that.
When was it that you first laid eyes on her, and what was the boat like at that point in time?
Well, I was working as a dot-commer in the Empire State Building, and I was in the heat of that dot-com buzz of activity, you know, working 17-hour days and all of this, and I had an opportunity to go down and volunteer on the fireboat, and I had no idea. I didn't even know what a fireboat was, but when the question came, hey, do you want to come down and get dirty, I was like, yes. I was excited to do that because I've been driving a desk for so long, and I went down, and before I knew it, I was kneeling on top of this enormous diesel engine, and I was using a sawzall, a power saw, to cut out no longer used heating pipe, and that was it. I was done. I was hooked, and it was the realest thing I had done in what felt like forever. And I was out on the Hudson. I was on this boat, and I was working with my hands, and I was hooked.
Yeah. Goodbye to the 58th floor of the Empire State Building.
Yeah. Well, it what helped was that my dot-com company imploded shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
It gave me the sort of the path to go and follow my passion. This boat is, it's really hard to translate the scale and what it looks like, you know, without pictures. But people can go to my website, myriverchronicles.com, and get some pictures. I'm going to be putting some more up there, too. And fireboat.org. Is also a great way to get a taste for the boat and see pictures and get a sense for the history. But it's 130 feet long, and it's 28 feet wide. And there are multiple deck levels, and probably the most defining feature is the aft tower on the back. It's a 15-foot tall tower that features some of the deck guns, or water cannons, or monitors, depending on who you are and what you want to call them. And this is the way that we shoot massive amounts of water from the river out into the air or into a fire, as the case may be.
Yeah. I haven't spent a lot of time on your website, but I do have in front of me now, on page 16 of My River Chronicles, the book opened to a photograph of the John J. Harvey. What an impressive sight. She's
well,
here at the...
Great photograph, too, because this is the Harvey showing off. She had just been commissioned the month before, and so she was going out for testing. And this is a moment in New York City history when, there were tremendous infrastructure projects that were happening, and the George Washington Bridge was brand new. And so in that photograph that you're referring to, yeah, you see these grand streams of water headed nearly vertically, and basically they were very proud that she shot water over the roadway of the George Washington Bridge, sort of taking on, you know, both newbies out there sort of proving themselves, the grand bridge and the grand fireboat.
Yeah. Well, while you were a bubblesalary.commer, it's also true, you say that you've always been intrigued by industry and industrial decay as well as power tools.
Yes.
How did those interests begin and take hold? And I suspect that really kicked in the first time you stepped aboard the John J. Harvey.
It's true. My father is a car mechanic, and so I always grew up surrounded by tools. I always grew up surrounded by the notion of if something's broken, you fix it. He'd also been a carpenter at one time. So it was a very do-it-yourself, hands-on upbringing. And yet, when you start trying something new, you're not necessarily going to be good at it. And, the few times I tried to do some hands-on work with my dad or around the house, let's just say they weren't necessarily successful, so I didn't really ever have the concept that this is work that I'd be able to do successfully. And I was good at school, so I focused on that and sort of went down the path and you know, I basically applied for scholarships to go away to a boarding school and then went off to college, and life sort of carved out this sort of white-collar existence that was very hands-off, and you know, the ultimate being dot-commer, which is working to make things that you can't even hold with your hands. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, walking aboard that boat and actually, you know, having this moment, I'll admit, I was a little brazen. I said, you know, hey, you know, would you like me to cut out the pipe, the next set of pipes? Because I'd seen the sawzall, and my dad used to, he had a sawzall, and he used to cut the tops off of the pumpkins when we were going to make a jack-o'-lantern with the sawzall. And so I figured, hey, you know, if you can cut a pumpkin with it, how hard could this be? you know, that's kind of, you know, the direction that brought me there.
Yeah. So what was the learning curve like?
Oh, God, it was tremendous. I always, you know, the day you wake up and don't have anything left to learn, you might as well go back to sleep, I figure. But it's a huge struggle. And it's, you know, I was in my late 20s when I started on the boat. And the older you get, the harder and harder it is to be really bad at something because you've never done it before. You know, it's, you know, we get sort of stuck in our egos and, you know, and wanting to be effective individuals. And it was really, really hard to walk in knowing nothing. And, you know, it's constant. And this boat, you know, frankly, my naivete really helped me because I didn't quite realize what I was getting into. And I had the utmost respect for the equipment, but I had no concept for how particularly challenging this engine room is. And, you know, more and more, even now, I have, you know, people who come in, engineers from other vessels, come in and just sort of go, wow, you got a lot going on here. So not knowing that was probably really helpful and helped me keep plugging away.
Describe the engine room for us.
Yeah, well, it's there are five engines. These are Fairbanks Morse, the post-piston diesels. And the diesel-electric configuration means that, I explain it to kids, you know how your mom or dad's driving the car and they put their foot on the gas and that makes the car go pretty directly? Well, this is a very different system. And what moves a boat through the water is a propeller, or in this case, two propellers, and those are not connected directly to the engine, is what I tell kids. Instead, how it works is that there are two large DC propulsion motors, and they get their power, their DC electricity, from generators that are connected to the back of each of the engines. And so basically the diesel makes the electricity makes the rotating motion on the propellers, and that's how we get to move through the water. We also, of course, you can't neglect the pumps. There are four pumps, one on each of the outboard engines. And all told, the boat is, if everything's working properly and at the same time, we can pump 18,000 gallons of water per minute, which is just a huge amount of water. And all that happens in the engine room. You know, the other thing that perhaps I should mention, too, is that this is a very unique boat in that it's a bell boat. And what that means is that the pilot, the person who's at the helm, and in the fire department they call them pilots rather than captains, so the pilot has control of the steering wheel that controls the rudder, but no actual control over the speed or direction of the propellers. That actually happens in the engine room, so we do that shifting. And the pilot rings down a bell and moves a little pointer on a dial and tells us how fast he wants to go and in which direction, and we actually make the change to the boat, to the propellers that actually move the boat.
Yeah. On the cover of the jacket,
yes,
for My River Chronicles, there's a photo of you at the helm in the pilot's place. And your view, though, in the engine room is nothing like that.
It's true. And that photograph, there's another boat in my life, and that is a 65-foot tugboat. And that photograph on the cover is actually me standing at the helm of the tug. And I do steer the tug. And that was actually a photograph that was taken the first time I ever steered. And so I'm, like, full of glee and also full of utter exhaustion because, as people can read in the book, we had some major engine problems, went through an incredible storm.
Yeah.
And in fact, to arrive in New York Harbor was kind of unexpected by that point. So that's what you see in my face on the cover.
Yeah, happy exhaustion.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Jessica DeLong is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of My River Chronicles, Rediscovering America on the Hudson. She is a Coast Guard licensed merchant marine officer. She's also a journalist. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call from a listener in Savoy waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Hello. I have heard tell that the diesel locomotives on railroads are not direct drive diesel engines either, that they're diesel electric. And so I was hoping you could explain to me why it is that way. Why did you have not direct drive? Why did you have, in effect, diesel electric motors in your boat?
Yeah, I'd be happy to explain it. The first thing to keep in mind, while there are other, you know, locomotives, but also other vessels that do use diesel-electric technology, in particular, this was really important for the fact that this was an emergency services vessel. And one of the most amazing things on this boat is the redundancy. So we have, I'll try to find a way to explain it simply, because I know I could give you a very long, like hour-long answer, but when the diesels are being used to pump water as well as to generate electricity, you lose some of the power. So they can't do both at the same time as effectively. And so what you have is a sort of division of labor in the engine room. And with five engines, I can swap propulsion over in various different ways. So I can use my centerline engine, for example. I can swap it so that half of it is powering port side and half of it is powering starboard side. Or I can set it up to power all port side or all starboard side. So basically, I guess the short answer is it's to have choices and to make sure that even in an emergency situation that you have full capacity while pumping water and maneuverability while pumping water, which has always been a challenge for fireboats, to make sure that they have enough power to move effectively and to, you know, to keep that flow of water going. I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How was it that this boat has managed to survive? At one point, it was almost headed for a scrap heap.
Yes, and really, I mean, it was so close to that. The second highest bidder basically had intended to bring this boat and chop it up and reuse the parts and you know, melt things down. So very close to the scrap heap. And the reality is that she very clearly had much more of a usable life left. The reason why is that she was built in 1931. This is an age when fine craftsmanship was the guiding principle in manufacturing. And I think that that's a piece of America's heritage that we need to get back to. Unfortunately, we've really gone the route of becoming this disposable culture mm-hmm. where products are you know, built or made to break as opposed to being built to last. And the fireboat for me, the John J. Harvey, really exemplifies. It stands as a really vivid and alive example of the way that fine craftsmanship can really make a good product and make it stay. And, you know, I really think that this is that things are shifting now and that there's a sort of reconfiguration in this country of the direction that we need to go. And for a long time, hands-on work and craftsmanship of that sort has been devalued and disrespected. And I think we're learning that the soul of America does not only exist on Wall Street, and that perhaps that's not the most sustainable model. And instead, I think we need to look back to the work that made America great, and that was a lot of muscle and sweat and hands-on work that we need to sort of reevaluate the importance of that.
Yeah, and that's a thread of the story in My River Chronicles that I think is another major theme.
Yeah, and you know, some people say, oh, well, you know, are you just being nostalgic? Are you being unrealistic? You know, is this globalization is just the way of the world? And No question. There are jobs, especially lower-skilled jobs, that have gone offshore and will stay there. And so I'm not suggesting that we need to sort of move backwards in time. Certainly, old-school industry, while I have absolute love for finding out the details of old, the way that things were made and done back a century ago, the thing is that what we need to do is make sure that American skills are cumulative, and I think that we need to integrate our high-tech, knowledge-based economy with our skills for making things. This is crucial, I think, for the United States to be the strong, productive, and self-sufficient nation that we need to be, and I think that the shifts in the economy are really changing people's perspective about that, and I'm glad to see it, and certainly the support from the top down, the Obama administration, has certainly made that a priority, recognizing that American manufacturing is crucial to America's future.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to just amplify a bit on the response to the earlier caller about the diesel-electric combinations. My dad was a electrical engineer for Westinghouse and designed a lot of the DC motors that went into craft like your guest is describing. And one of the beautiful things about DC motors is they're really dumb, which means that the more electricity you pour into them, the more horsepower they generate. And they're particularly effective in emergency vehicles because they respond much faster and they can be reversed and controlled much faster than a direct diesel engine coupling, which is why in very heavy horsepower ratings like the diesel-electric locomotives and in the Coast Guard rescue craft, they're really the choice. They're really the kind of Cadillac of high horsepower, high response combination. It seems kind of silly. If you've got the diesel engine, why don't you just gear it to the props? But it's actually a much more efficient use of the power this way. So I love the discussion. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. Jessica?
Yeah, absolutely. He's 100% correct and very well put, so thank you very much. Yes, the flexibility and the power and the choices, all of those things informed the choice for how to power the vote. Yes, definitely.
Our guest is Jessica DuLong. She is the author of My River Chronicles, Rediscovering America on the Hudson. Another part of this story of this boat that's significant is that she was called back into service following the terrorist attacks of September 11th. Tell us about that.
Well, it was very clear when this group of preservationists took over ownership of the vessel that we were not to be engaged in any firefighting activities. And really, all the rules changed when the city was blindsided. And what happened was the Coast Guard put out a call for all available boats to stop whatever they were doing and race down to the site to help. And the first need and really crucial need was to evacuate passengers. And what many people don't realize is that 300,000 individuals were evacuated Manhattan Island by boat. And it's just interesting because it's very easy when you're in big-time New York City to sort of forget that you're on an island. But let me tell you, that became really, really important in those days where you were either on the island or off the island. And a lot of people wanted to get off, and the boats helped make that happen. So the John J. Harvey was in the midst of evacuating passengers when a then-lieutenant, now-retired captain in the fire department named Tommy White, ended up radioing the John J. Harvey and asking for the Harvey to come back and actually serve the purpose for which he had been built, which for me is really, that's kind of a magical moment in that this is what she had been built to do. And had she been sent off to scrap, she would not have been available to serve this function, which is her purpose for being. And so she did. So basically the passengers were dropped off and the boat returned to the site and started pumping Hudson River water to the firefighters on land. And the other thing that many people don't realize is that in the first few days following the collapse of the towers, Hudson River water was the only water available on the site. That was water that was provided by not only the fireboat John J. Harvey, but also the active duty Marine Division boats for the Fire Department of New York. Those boats provided the water that was so necessary while buses were burning, while buildings were inflamed. And the fact that the Hudson River water, made that change and was there at this other pivotal moment in New York's and in the country's history is kind of profound.
How did the Harvey perform?
Very, very well. There was a consistent pumping responsibility, and again, because of the redundancy of the engines, even after pumping at higher pressures than normal, when there were some seal issues, which was sort of to be expected when you're overworking your equipment, we were able to swap pumping to other engines to be able to compensate for that need of continuous service. And yes, she did the work that she was built to do. There was definitely a modification that needed to be made, and Chief Engineer Tim Ivory, absolutely brilliant mechanic and really good in a crisis, he came up with a completely ingenious solution for attaching hoses to the deck nozzles, which are typically used to just sort of spray water out into the air or the sky or towards the fire directly. And instead, he configured a way to attach the hose lines to the deck guns to compensate for the fact that we had some valves that had frozen had rusted. And she did her job. She did her job very well, and all the way through Friday afternoon when the fire department actually relieved us of duty.
Okay, so then how long did the boat work the fire?
From Tuesday morning until Friday.
Okay.
Yeah, consistently.
Yeah. I wonder what those days were like for those of you on board the Harvey.
It's hard to explain, and frankly, that was definitely the hardest chapter to write. For me, the crucial moment, there were a number of crucial moments, but one of them was arriving, and I arrived on September 12th. The boat was already working, and when I got there, because I was stuck in Brooklyn, and there's the Manhattan being an island, all the bridges and tunnels and subway system, everything was shut down. When I arrived, I saw the pumps actually, actively working, and I saw the water coming out of the deck nozzles and realized what was happening. And I just, even in the midst of all of this horror, I just had this complete rush of love for this boat that was doing her job as she was supposed to be. We've done water displays for so many groups, kids, joy ride cruises, just for fun, water displays. And here, this was a very serious purpose being performed, and it really was just a testament to the fact that this boat was built so well, and in an age when that mattered to people, and for me that was really tremendous.
Yeah, it also must have been something for you and for the others aboard the Harvey to be able to work that boat and to be there.
Yeah, I was really very new with the boat when this happened. We had just taken our first magical cruise. We had just gone up the Hudson River for the first time. The boat had never gone so far north, and basically took this camping trip. That was in August, and so this was just a couple weeks later, and we were called in, to do this work that was so important and so serious and so. Words are escaping me. It's a little bit hard to talk about, but I know that it meant a lot to the crew, all of us, to have something that we could offer, because so many people were walking around New York, as I had been on in Brooklyn on the first day, trying to donate blood, talking to police officers, trying to, offer up whatever support we could, and I remember a police officer said to me, listen, they don't know what to do with us, you know. And I just, that moment of helplessness and not being able to provide anything, to do anything to help, was really painful. And so as soon as I found out that there was something that I could do that might help just a little bit, and that, you know, that moment of realization and of being able to be there was an absolute honor and privilege, because so many people wanted to contribute, wanted to do anything that needed to be done, and didn't have the vehicle. And so I'm immensely grateful, as I know my crew members are, you know, to have been able to try to do something.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Jessica DeLong, author of My River Chronicles, Rediscovering America on the Hudson. Jessica DeLong is a journalist. She is also a Coast Guard licensed merchant marine officer. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our listener who called in first this afternoon in Savoy is back with us again with another question or a comment. Let's go and take that call now. Line one, hi. Line one.
I'm late, and I got 3 points I want to make quickly. The first one is I want to thank the caller for upgrading all our knowledge about diesel electric motive power. That was definitely A+. A quick question. What is the boat being used for now?
The boat is operating as a living museum, essentially. We give dockside tours and take trips up and down the Hudson River, and basically share the experience of being on board and this this one-of-a-kind technology with people. And also, we bring a lot of kids who have, even though they live on Manhattan Island, they really don't necessarily have a concept. They've never been out on the water. And so we give adults and children the chance to go out and experience their city and their river in a different way. And our primary objective and primary purpose is to preserve the boat for the next generation. That's our guiding principle and the most important thing that we do.
Excellent. I take it could still be called back into service again.
I wouldn't want to venture a guess.
I mean, it's capable.
You know, God forbid.
I mean, it's able to do so.
Where, on a good day, yes.
Yeah, where is the boat now in terms of restoration? Because I think at some point in the book you say this is a boat always in need of repair.
Yes, and you know, every boat is in constant need of repair. And there, you know, if you talk to boaters, there are lots of jokes that go back and forth about you know, the sort of bottomless pit of need that any vessel, whether it's a fiberglass runabout or a 130-foot steel-hulled fireboat. Certainly this boat has special needs, and the challenge here is that she was constructed with technology that we don't do anymore. She was a riveted hull. She was put together. It's basically like assembling a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle. The care and intentionality and planning that goes into fitting this plate together with rivets, which is basically just a mechanical seal. Today we're used to putting steel plates together by welding, and this is just a completely different technology that depends on heat and clearances between the metal to actually make the boat watertight. When I first grasped how riveting works and the fact that it does work to keep the water out is still sort of boggles my mind, even though I understand the technology of it. It does sort of have a magical quality to it. The trouble here, though, is that riveting is not technology that many people know how, or certainly in the maritime world, people just don't make boats this way anymore. And that means that many people don't know how to repair them effectively. And so we've had, you know, some problems in the shipyard with, you know, welders basically looking to do what they do on other vessels, which is just weld away. And the reality is that putting that much heat into the steel actually separates the seams, the cocked seams that are crucial to riveting. I don't want to get too technical, but I think, you know, those are some of the challenges that we face. And part of what I discovered in both my work and also in research for this book was really the tremendous need that we have to keep some of these older technologies alive, because they help us understand the way the world works. And one of the most magical things about old technology is how physical it is. And I think that, you know, giving young people and older people the opportunity to actually experience some of these things hands-on is a tremendous gift.
Okay, so Savoy caller, anything else? No.
Hello.
Okay, we got you.
Okay, I'm back. Okay. My last point is that I wanted to stress for everyone that all the things she's talking about, and if she can tell us, she doesn't have to give us the names, but I think it'd be fine to do that, but at least the job titles of these people that were aiming this boat to be dismantled and destroyed. My point is those people that wear suits, and they're jokingly called men in suits nowadays, they're not any smarter than the other people who don't know how to do this technology anymore. So the mental brain power of people who are making stupid decisions in offices is just as bad nowadays, and I think as a nation we're in a fair amount of trouble. And if our guest would like to comment on that, I'll be happy to listen.
Okay,
thoughts? I'm gonna hang up now.
Okay, thanks for the call. Thoughts, Jessica?
Yeah, I you know, the caller is talking about a really core issue, which is we've gotten away from our roots in this country, and we kind of forgot how much brain power it takes to do physical work. You know, we have this separation of brain and brawn, but the reality is I, as many callers, I'm sure, know incredibly bright people who do hands-on work, people who don't have college degrees. And the notion that hands-on work doesn't require brains is just a myth. One of the most satisfying things about the work that I do on the John J. Harvey and also on the tug that I work on is I absolutely love the physical exhaustion, just knowing that you have worked your body to the absolute maximum that you could do. You've pushed yourself to your limits, and that you know, it's a very physically satisfying feeling. But the other thing is the integration of the mind and body. I have faced the most challenging diagnostics, the most challenging sort of problem-solving situations. It's a constant intellectual challenge to me to do my job, even though I'm sitting there shifting these big brass levers and you know, my arms are sore at the end of the day and my hands get calloused. It's the mental challenge that a lot of times people don't realize, where you're making split-second decisions that really absolutely are make or break in terms of saving equipment, protecting equipment, and making sure that everybody gets safely back to the dock. That the assumption that the caller is talking about, that somehow if you're in a suit, you're better, it's definitely worn out its welcome, I think, in this country. And I think that there's a piece of the American soul that we need to get back in touch with.
It was 400 years ago this fall 2009, that Henry Hudson made his historic voyage on the river that now bears his name, began his expedition of the river. Are there special things that the city, the people of the city of New York, are doing to celebrate those centuries between Henry Hudson and today? And this has got to be a great opportunity to display history and craftsmanship and take a look, take a moment to think about where we are and where we're headed.
I definitely think that this is a crucial moment to do that reassessment. Henry Hudson, when he arrived, he's quoted as saying most of his writings actually disappeared. And interesting little twist of fate, he kept a very careful log, we hear. And I think that his log was actually sold as scrap paper, which I think is an interesting little irony in terms of the disposable culture we were talking about earlier. But one of the records, one of the quotes that has stood the test of time is that he said, "This land is the finest for cultivation that I've ever set foot upon." And so his arrival basically opened the door to the European marketplace and really launched globalization. And it is a really important time to reassess his explorations. While he failed in his mission, I mean, he was not looking to find the Hudson River. He was trying to get to China and went a long way and was very disappointed and took a very disappointed trip back home downriver. But the reality is that he opened up
the quote-unquote New World, and obviously there were people here already. The Native Americans were living on the Hudson River for a long time before he got here, but it shifted gears entirely. And the city of New York has been, and actually the entire Hudson River Valley has been doing celebrations all summer long. We have done a bunch of different, celebrations and events and educational opportunities, and one that's happening now is called Working on Water, and it's basically a tour of historic work boats primarily, and so giving people in towns all up and down the Hudson River a little taste of the maritime heritage that is the reason that their towns exist on the river. So I do think that, it offers people an opportunity to reassess the valuable resource of the Hudson River that's in their backyard and understand it as former birthplace of American industry. So I think a lot of times we lose sight of that as we look at the river and see it's beautiful and think about going for a boat ride and recreational, but this was the lifeblood of American industry here on the Hudson River, and a lot of people are getting another look at that, which is great.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Jessica DeLong, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. And I appreciate the callers calling in with questions, too. Thank you.
Jessica DeLong is a fireboat engineer on the John J. Harvey. She's also a journalist and the author of My River Chronicles, Rediscovering America on the Hudson. The publisher, Simon & Schuster. There's a website, myriverchronicles.com. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in now from Kansas City and Chicago. Here with those numbers, Todd Gleason.
Thanks so much, Celeste. The numbers finished up like this in Chicago on this Thursday afternoon. Futures in the wheat pit nearby is up 3.75 today. Had a high price this afternoon at $4.34, a low at $4.28 with a settlement price today at $4.32 up 3.75 in that nearby September contract for the wheat. December futures of 4.62.5 top, bottom at 53, settled at 58.75, 2.5 higher in the March contract of 4.81 high, low at 4.73, settled at 4.78.5 up 2.5 cents. July contract for the soft red, 5.05 the high, low at $4.97. Next year's harvest month for the soft red winter wheat up 2.25. July finished at 5.02¼. In Kansas City, where the hard red is traded, $4.62.5, the settlement price up 2 cents on the afternoon. September corn futures, 4 cents higher today, 313.5 the high, low at 305, settlement price at $3.09, up 4, December, 319 the high, low at 308.5, settlement price at 315.25, up 5.5 cents, in the March, 332.5 the high, the low at 22, settlement price at $3.28¾, up 5.5 cents. May futures, 341.5 the high, the low at $3.31¼, settlement price at $3.38, up 5.25. July corn, 350 the high, the low at 40¾. Settlement price for the July contract at 346.5, up 5.25. And next year's December futures, the harvest month 2010 in the corn pit, up a nickel today. 369.5 the high, the low at 60. Settlement price at $3.65.5. September oats today, 195.25. The settlement price up 3.75. December 3.75 higher as well at $2.07¼. From the soy complex now, nearby soybean futures up 12 cents, $9.79 the high in the September. The low at 961.5 with a settlement price. September beans at $9.73.5, a 12-cent gain today. November, though, down 2 cents. 934.75 the high. The low at 925. Settled two lower at 926.5 for the November beans. In January futures, 941.5 the high. The low at $9.32. Settled at 933.5, down 2.25. The March contract, 946.5 the high. The low at 37. Settle at $9.38¾, down 2.25 in the May futures, 9.48 the high, the low at 37. Settled at $9.38¼, down 4 cents. November beans of next year, that harvest month at 9.15 top, bottom at 9.05, settlement price at $9.10½. November beans for 2010, up 4 cents on the day. September bean meal futures now, 352.90 the high, the low at 348, settlement price at 349, finished 20 cents higher. October, $294 a ton, the high price, the low at 289.10. October bean meal, 289.50 on it, settlement down $1.30. September soybean oil, $34 the high, the low at 33.62. settled 33.70, 3 cents lower. The October down three as well, with a settlement price at $33.86, the high at $34.31, the low at $33.75. Settlement price for that October contract in the soybean oil at $33.86. It finished down 3 cents. Recapping those numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade, nearby corn futures were up four. Most of that pit up 4 to 5 cents for the day. Wheat futures were a penny to 2 cents higher. And the soy complex, both sides of the trade, nearby September's were up 12, but November's were down two. We'll take a complete look at the reasons behind the moves during the afternoon, during the closing market report this afternoon. That'll come up in just about 6 minutes now when we'll talk with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. Don't forget, tomorrow morning, the big USDA crop production report for the month of September due out at 7:30, along with the world agricultural supply and demand estimates. Dave Dickey will bring you updates of those at 8:50 and 9:50, and we'll recap them at 2:06 in the afternoon Friday. With the closing market report, don't forget to sign up for our weekend newsletter. We'll put those numbers in that newsletter tonight. And update it, actually, in the morning at 7:30 a.m. Just hit subscribe at willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Now let's turn our attention to the livestock contracts. Cattle finished lower on the day today, while lean hogs finished on the upside. October live cattle, 87.92 and a half the high, 87.20 the low. The settlement, 87.22 and a half, that down 32 and a half. December, 87.65 the high, 86.90 the low. The settlement, 87.15 down 27 and a half. February, 88.47 and a half the high, 87.75 the low. The settlement, 88.07 and a half down 12 and a half. April, 90.35 the high, the low, 89.80. The settlement, 90.07 and a half down 22 and a half. September feeder cattle, 99.90 the high, 99.35 the low, 99.50 the settlement, that down 30. October, $100.10 the high, 99.47 and a half the low, 99.77 and a half the settlement, down 45. November, $100.90 the high, $100.15 the low, $100.35 the settlement, finishing down 67 and a half. January feeder cattle, 101.60 the high, $100.90 the low, the settlement, $100.95, that down 90. October lean hogs, 54 even the high, 51.75 the low, the settlement, 52.42 and a half, that finishing up 97 and a half. December, 52.10 the high, 49.90 the low, 50.70 the settlement, that up 105. February, 58.55 the high, 56.55 the low, the settlement 56.97 and a half, up 75. April lean hog, 63.42 and a half the high, the low 61.90, the settlement 62.77 and a half, up 95. And February bellies, 88.42 and a half the high, 86.80 the low, 88.15 the settlement, that up 172 and a half. The Dow is up 66 points at 96.14. The NASDAQ up 19 at 2,079. The S&P 500 up 8 at 1,042. Nearby crude in New York trading up 63 cents a barrel at 71.95.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
Expertise to regulate expanded carbon markets, but would need more manpower to provide.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. This is the afternoon magazine. Our technical director, Henry Frain, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, with assistance this week from Martha Deal.